Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hi, and welcome to Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network. We are your hosts, Jenny Goodman.
And Alex McCreary.
Opening Soon is a weekly show that will walk you through the steps of opening a restaurant through conversations with some of the world's greatest chefs, restaurateurs, and the vendors that help take their business from just an idea to opening soon.
Jenny and I have been in the hospitality business for over 25 years. I've been fortunate enough to be part of opening one restaurant that still stands today, and humbled enough to have owned one restaurant named Goods that lasted less than 6 months. When launching Goods, we failed to create a business plan before jumping in. We didn't bother with a partnership agreement, and we missed some major components of our income statement. Our experience with Goods is a big reason we feel we're the ones that can ask the questions. Basically, we need answers.
Aside from our own firsthand experience inside restaurants, including one pretty epic fail, we are currently the founders of Tillit NYC, a hospitality workwear brand that has proudly outfitted over 4,000 restaurants and counting since launching our business in 2012. We are so fortunate to witness many restaurants come to life. Being part of that journey is one of the best parts of our job, and we want to share that feeling and all those lessons that can be learned with all of you.
Our goal is that this podcast will help bridge the gap between the teacher and the student, help alleviate some of the risk when you're opening your restaurant, and offer you some lessons that you might have been looking for when building your business plan.
So the first 12-episode season will sequentially take you through the steps of your business plan, from choosing your partners to nailing design and to getting those doors actually open. We will be picking the brains of industry leaders, including Chef Missy Robbins, Camilla Marcus, and Steven Satterfield, just to name a few. So if you're in the process of building a business plan, just starting culinary school, improving or expanding in your current business, or just fascinated by what it takes to get the restaurant open, we hope this podcast will entertain, educate, and inspire you on your journey from idea to opening soon.
Follow the journey on Heritage Radio and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at We Are Opening Soon and at Tillit NYC.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And today, we're taking a look at the kitchen. The kitchen and its evolution from a dreary workspace room to a room of style and convenience, the place where everyone ends up gathering. I'm sure most of you have seen movies or TV shows, think Downton Abbey, with the scullery or the bare basic prep kitchen, often in the basement. And then, as a modern flip side, I'm sure many of you have seen photos or films of the space age kitchen of the 50s and 60s as portrayed in the cartoon show The Jetsons. Or you've remembered it in all those vintage appliance ads, which sort of pop up every so often, Mad Men style, to illustrate and even sometimes mock the era. And then there are all those familiar household brands like Formica, Pyrex, KitchenAid, and Frigidaire. Just think, refrigerators and dishwashers? Wow. This was all part of a leap in technology of the post-World War II era, which was applied to consumers' practical use, specifically in the kitchen. And my guest today has documented that movement in her new book. Sarah Archer is a writer and curator who specializes in design and material culture, specifically mid-century culture. She contributes to Slate, The Atlantic, Architectural Digest, and NewYorker.com. Her new book is Mid-Century Kitchen, America's Favorite Room, from Workspace to Dream Space, 1940s to 1970s. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
The title, the full title of your book, we're just going to call it The Mid-Century Kitchen. But that
for short, yeah.
The full title really says a lot. So much is packed into that title from the time period, 1940s. You can even go back to the 1920s, really, 1920s to the 1970s. And workspace to dream space. Wow. Describe, I mean, and I say 1920s because a lot of this, some technology started in the 20s, or at
it
least
did,
some of the thought,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Describe to us how far we've come.
Incredibly far. And I think it's sort of all of the, any design that you encounter that seems really innovative from kind of circa World War One, in some sense was kind of thwarted by the two world wars and the Great Depression. So there were things like refrigerators existed in the 1920s, and there are lots of like super glam 1920s kind of ads that feature people kind of who look like they're at a very glamorous cocktail party standing next to like a GE monitor top refrigerator to kind of show how it was like the latest chic thing, and it was almost like having an extra servant who didn't interrupt the dinner party. But not many people had those appliances back then, and it's for a couple of reasons. Like anything from, certain typefaces that were popular in the teens and 20s to clothing, deconstructed modern clothing, didn't really take hold until decades later. And it's partly because consumerism was halted by the World Wars and the Depression. So lots of the technology that we think of as quote-unquote post-war, because that was really the time period when tens of millions of people suddenly had, fully outfitted suburban kitchens with a refrigerator and a dishwasher and a gas range, may not have had that 20 years earlier, even though it was available.
That's true. And we're not even, when you think about it, we're not even referring totally to technology. Think about things like countertops and cabinets. I mean, there was no such thing, right? There was the big old work table.
It was a big work table. That's the thing that is so mind-blowing, to look at a lot of these photographs that were documented either by people like, Lewis Hine, sort of documenting tenements, or even WPA photographs from the 1930s of farmhouse kitchens, like as recently as, less than 100 years ago. The kitchen, as we think of it, as a kind of standard type of a room that has all the kind of expected appliances, whether it's a $500 stove from Home Depot or a $30,000 stove from La Cornue or something in between, is a relatively recent idea. And that's kind of mind-blowing when you consider how, important the kitchen is to daily life. But essentially, before the mid-20th century, often what you would find were kitchens in kind of great houses, great estates, as mentioned Downton Abbey, were kind of workspaces for staff, and they weren't a place where you would hang out and, kind of do your homework after school or make a cup of tea. It was almost like the garage or the basement. It was just this kind of functional workspace in the home versus a one-room apartment in a city or a one or two-room farmhouse. You might have a cast iron stove as the only appliance and then have kind of the living space kind of nestled around that kitchen apparatus. So it wasn't sort of like the kitchen has always been a standard type of room. It really has evolved quite a bit since that time period.
Right. Well, what technologies do you really devote this major shift? You mentioned refrigeration, and for sure that was a gigantic technological advance for people in the kitchen. But what else, what other things would you mention on that, along that line?
Certainly municipal water and gas lines and electricity.
Running water, folks.
Running water. It's like, we take it for granted, but it's like before those exist, having kind of a modern hygienic kitchen was impossible. Mm-hmm. And, having electricity paves the way for refrigeration, having gas lines paves the way for gas stoves, which are, suddenly then you don't have to shovel coal into a cast iron stove every time you want to boil the kettle, every time somebody wants to take a shower or bath, every time you want to cook something. So that becomes a major leap forward in convenience and safety. And refrigeration, too, kind of completely transforms over decades how people shopped. Instead of having to shop for produce or food every day, You can kind of do your shopping for the week and sort of, you know, plan out your menu as you go.
That's right. I was going to mention that the impact that has, and all these things have, on food and how food is delivered to the home. I mean, it's really pretty phenomenal. In the 20s, before all this started, though, there was quite an innovative, invention, but the Frankfurt kitchen is what I'm referring to. And it was very little, you know, not very well known here. It was developed by a German woman, first German architect, right?
In Austria, yes.
In Austria, right.
To qualify as an architect in Austria.
Right. Oh, in Austria, right. And, but the Museum of Modern Art had a wonderful display. It was on the whole on the World War II efforts and supporting efforts and the boom of technology around both world wars, as you mentioned. But describe that Frankfurt kitchen for us. It was supposed to be like the ultimate model in efficiency.
Yes, and it represented a huge leap forward for working class and middle class families and women in particular. It was part of this sort of utopian urban project called New Frankfurt that was being designed by Max Ernst in Austria after the war. And Ernst May, I'm sorry.
He did that too.
he was busy. Yeah. There was this idea that it was kind of like this, you know, there's this horrible destruction in the wake of World War I, but it's also a chance to rebuild better and to give working people access to green space and sunlight and amenities like childcare and, you know, public parks. And the kitchen design, the sort of standard kitchen design, was part of that. And she did something that was unusual for a middle-class dwelling. I mentioned there had been, you know, kind of staff kitchens in great houses and then kind of just kitchens that were kind of like occupying the entire living space in more humble kinds of housing. Schutz-Lachowski moved the kitchen into kind of a separate room that was relatively small. And she studied the work of an American home economist named Christine Frederick, who did these wonderful illustrations of kind of footpaths, motion studies in kitchens. She herself also studied the work of an engineer named Frederick Taylor, who had worked with Bethlehem Steel and lots of other big companies kind of during the Gilded Age as a consultant, sort of doing motion studies and figuring out, you know, the fewest number of steps necessary to do a particular task and where, you know, what was the ideal position for a particular tool and that kind of thing to sort of make the most of factory layout. Christine Frederick applied these ideas to the kitchen, as though the kitchen was a new sort of factory that made, you know, food and domesticity, you know, made everybody happy.
An efficiency mode.
it was efficiency. And she and Schutz-Lachowski, for her part, studied that and made this very kind of compact kitchen space that required relatively few steps. There was rational storage that almost looks like it comes straight out of Catherine Beaker's, you know, 1869 treatise on home economy. There were lots of neat little drawers, little bins for things like rice and flour, easy to clean surfaces because this was a moment when hygiene was starting to be well understood, germ theory. It was a real kind of sense of like we need to keep things separate, wash our hands, make sure that there's a place for things to be set aside and not be cross-contaminated if you're working with raw, you know, raw chicken or what have you. Color, there's lots of, you know, lovely bright blue, and there's kind of different versions of it, but there's a really nice version at the museum in Austria that's kind of blue and orange, and along with white. And it didn't have a refrigerator, so that was the one thing that it didn't have. But apart from that, it has a remarkable similarity to the kitchens that we basically all have now. That, you know, there's a certain amount of storage, there's compact workspace, everything sort of has its place, and it's easy, and above all, it's easy to clean.
Right. The one I saw the one at the Museum of Modern Art.
At MoMA, yeah.
And what struck me, it's not something that I would feel comfortable working in, as you say, it was everything was small, very efficient, you know, and you didn't really have to waste any motion to get from one section to the other. What I was remarking on to someone when I saw it was the chair. There was always a place to sit, which is something that we should, I think, adopt once again.
I actually, it's funny, that was sort of a feature of the kitchen I had growing up. My parents, and still have, had you know, a relatively compact Manhattan kitchen that had, mm-hmm. you know, sort of just enough counter space, but there was always a stool so you could kind of perch and hang out in there, right. which I always loved. And that's, it wasn't part of the kitchen design. It was just something that they did.
But I mean, this was, hers was really part of the design where you sat,
right.
you sat
really
and peeled
in.
Potatoes right into a right. garbage chute. You know.
Exactly. Yeah, so everything has its place.
Right.
And the critique of that that's interesting is that sort of in the 70s, looking back on it, feminist architectural historians would say, well, that really isolates women.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of, it sends the message that you're the only one who belongs in here and there's sort of nobody else, you know, is meant to be quote unquote helping. So it was a big innovation, but also kind of had its limitations too.
Well, and well, as did a few others, which as we go forward, we can see, because then we move forward. Okay. Another war came about and then the big boom, the post-war boom occurred. And that actually, you even indicated in your book, and so many wonderful archival advertisements, photographs from the old advertisements. I love them. But you even remarked that after this whole post-boom movement, you know, this feeling of optimism represented mm-hmm. by all the pastel colors. Kind of mm-hmm. descriptors of the era, wouldn't you say? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. It's kind of childlike, and I think it's interesting too because one of the things that I've noticed, a lot of people are surprised to hear that there was a really strong connection between kitchen appliances and the auto industry during this period. There was, you know, Frigidaire was owned by General Motors, so if uh-huh. you went to Motorama to see all the new kind of the latest greatest cars. You might also see a model kitchen, and there may also have been, you know, designers. There was a group of female designers known as the Damsels in Design who were in the late 50s working on things like sort of adding elements like cup holders and makeup mirrors to cars that executives thought would appeal to this new class of consumer, you know, the middle-class household.
Right.
And so there was enormous crossover between those two things, and the pastel colors were kind of, to me, they really symbolize the sense that as women were kind of coming off the assembly line and coming back into the home after the war, there was a real sense of discouraging women from pursuing work outside the home because that was, you know, we have to have those jobs for the guys who are coming back. And there's a sense almost that the home becomes like a new version of the Victorian cocoon that's separate from kind of the big bad world. And all of those pastel colors are, I mean, I think to our perspective, they look sort of childlike, like you would decorate a child's bedroom in, you know, pale yellow and, you know, and so all of these appliances and countertops and, you know, all these new materials like Formica give you the sense that it's kind of a stylish room that is not really kind of ready for prime time in a sense. Like it's really, it's very, you know, kind of domestic and cozy, and it's for women and kids. It's not for guys.
Yeah. And transitory too. I mean, you figure something that color can't have lasting power, right? Staying power.
Right, exactly.
It's, you know,
yeah,
but
that's
then,
a good point. Yeah.
But of course, for myself, being a child of that era, I mean, I remember too the, you know, the pale pink Thunderbird that looked like a lot of the kitchen appliances that were pale pink. I mean, you know, yes, indeed, there's a lot of connection between the automotive industry and those modern kitchens.
It's wild, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
really.
So
like something's going to take off. And yet, you know, with all these advancements took place, and I encourage people to order the book, see the book, and look at these. Go to your bookstore and look through. If you don't remember the ads or don't remember the series Mad Men, which was just yesterday, it still is on reruns. It was really quite a dramatic shift from where we once were. Well, you know the.
Mm-hmm.
Even in, you know, and when things started to change with a little bit of refrigeration and maybe a cook stove, I mean, people were still working out of what's called the Hoosier cabinet, right?
Yeah, the Hoosier cabinet, which is actually, and they've become kind of collectible because some of them are really lovely objects, like as pieces of furniture. But the Hoosier cabinet really comes out of, it's kind of a modified baker's cabinet, old-fashioned baker's cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
They were really popular from sort of circa 1880 through kind of the turn of the 20th century, and they had elements that were actually not unlike the Frankfurt kitchen. They had lots of bins and you could kind of sit, you know, store your flour in there. And I think what that tells you is that it's an era when people are buying things kind of in bulk and not in the kind of the way that we're used to, where you buy kind of a package of, you know, brand, whatever brand, flour or sugar or what have you. And it's kind of, you have these quantities of ingredients because you're making most things from scratch because there isn't just sort of bread on the shelf that stays on the shelf, and spices and all that kind of stuff. And also, a lot of them were made with enamel surfaces because that was more hygienic. So it's sort of around the time of World War One. There's this big increase in interest in, it's also the Spanish flu, you know, being able to keep things really clean.
Right.
So inorganic materials like enamel and glass are suddenly really popular again. And if you look at kitchens, especially into the 20s, they have, that's kind of right before the craze for color really comes in. And there's this moment when kitchens almost kind of look like hospitals and they're, everything is white and there's, you know, all of these like very clean, austere surfaces, like you could, you know, do surgery in there if you really had to. And then the 30s and 40s come along and there's this kind of increasing interest in kind of the use of color as a marketing tool and, you know, kind of having fashion colors in your kitchen. But it, yeah, it, the, so the Hoosier cabinet really is kind of a transitional object almost between kind of the old-fashioned Victorian kitchen or kitchen of even centuries before that, where it was just some furniture in a room with a heat source. Table, right. You know, not part of a suite, but just kind of whatever you had.
Well, and interesting, not even, I mean, eat-in kitchens were, that was unheard of as well. And that, you know,
right.
became the era of the right. eat-in kitchen. There was always a table and chairs for a family of, the perfect family of four or six or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, it's not surprising to see the influence of Christine Frederick's, you know, home, with home economics and Taylorism being the fact that a kitchen is basically a factory in a way.
You know,
yeah. You've got to have that efficiency and the motion. And not surprising, you know, that whole efficient triangle that they developed for, it was a triangle that they developed, you know, to save space for the kitchen. So you go from, what was it?
The work triangle.
Right, the work triangle, minimum steps from the stove to the refrigerator to the sink. You know, it still applies today when planning kitchens.
Yeah.
It's amazing that
absolutely.
It's amazing. Broke.
Basically, what they found themselves doing were kind of mapping out how people would use these new technologies, because it's kind of, we, you know, the idea of sort of home economics has become kind of, you know, at best passe and at most, you know, kind of a joke, that the idea that you would devote like real scientific study to the idea of, you know, baking a cake or something, it seems kind of silly to us. But it seems silly in a way because it was so pervasive and so successful. Like the fact that somebody actually kind of mapped this out and thought of it has, you know, made it so that these rooms, which were full of all these new resources, like running water and appliances, it's like, how, you know, this is a complete radical change. It's almost the equivalent in magnitude to the way that computers have changed our lives and the way
That's
that
right.
our living spaces and the, you know, the way that we, you know, have to now be told to look where we're going when we walk down the street because, you know, we have these new devices. It was a technology that really disrupted how people lived, and it needed to be, somebody needed to spell it out,
right.
you know, to kind of do that research and map it out for people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, it's interesting. The technology was so desired, and this whole, the whole push for science and technology, I mean, our whole, the whole school education curriculum changed around that time when once the Russians put a, you know, Sputnik into space, the whole hour here in America, our curriculum changed and science was the major focus. So much so that this technology and that particularly the technology of the kitchen was politicized when Nixon arranged a meeting with Khrushchev and exchanged a sort of a science fair, if you will. Can you tell us about that?
That was an amazing moment, and it was the amazing thing too is that it was actually not planned. They ended up talking in front of the model kitchen display, which had been designed by Whirlpool at the 1959 American Exposition in Moscow. And they did a series of there were some in New York too. They did these kind of exchange expositions that weren't exactly world's fairs, but kind of borrowed a kind of display strategy from the idea of a World's Fair where you'd have model homes and fashion shows and stuff like that. And they ended up having this argument, which is now known as the kitchen debate, in front of this model kitchen, which was described as a typical kind of kitchen that a sort of an ordinary American worker and family could afford. And it was something in the dollars of that time, something like maybe, you know, a house cost $18,000 or whatever. And, you know, you could afford that on a salary of whatever was average back then. And it had, you know, washer, dryer, and all the sort of latest, greatest appliances. And they get into this argument because essentially Khrushchev says, like, well, we don't, you know, force our women to, you know, to be, you know, domestic slaves like that. We have, you know, this idea that, and to some extent, this is a little bit later in the decades. If you actually have been watching the series Chernobyl on HBO, there were a great many women in the Soviet Union who studied math and science and ended up working in medicine and physics and all sorts of things. There was a real push for what we call STEM among women, and that was actually quite unusual, more so than here. So there's this sort of interesting idea that, you know, Nixon, of all people, is kind of espousing how great this technology is, and then Khrushchev is offering what we might think of as like a feminist critique of, you know, gender essentialism, like, you know,
that,
not just
and that
gender.
And that leads me to the nexus. And this is 1959, remember? So, you know,
yeah,
these, and a lot of the things were actually in that model kitchen were sort of fake. I mean, they weren't really working. I mean, they had to sort of be...
Right. The Whirlpool display kitchen was kind of a piece of stagecraft in some ways. There was this kind of remote-controlled, amazing, like what we would call a Roomba, essentially, like a remote vacuum that looked, that had, sort of looked like a part of a 1950s car. Like it has, it's kind of streamlined and has, you know, fins, and it's kind of an ochre color, yellow ochre. And it presaged the modern Roomba. It was supposed to work like that. It didn't actually work automatically the way they do now, the way our Roombas do now. So it had to be operated remotely by a sort of a radio control from behind a scrim. So there was a guy kind of behind the kitchen kind of, you know, operating it. And there was supposed to be this kind of command center, kind of proto-computer where women could, you know, keep track of their expenses and, you know, organize recipes and make shopping lists and that kind of stuff. Also a little bit of stagecraft.
Right,
so it's, the appliances that Whirlpool was selling at the time, of course, worked. But all these other kind of, like, it was kind of an aspirational kitchen of tomorrow and speaks to this desire during this time period for sort of kitchens of the future. There was this obsession with, you know, what will, you know, we had in the last 30 years all these new appliances and all these new innovations. You know, what will come next? As though the next 30 years would bring, you know, every bit of innovation that the previous decades had. And of course they didn't, because essentially once you've got a stove and a dishwasher and a fridge, like, you're kind of set.
Yeah,
right? Like,
what else do you need, right? More counter space, right?
More counter space, more different colors. Yeah. And so then you start getting into kind of like, all right, the technology kind of is what it is, but now you can do, you can, you know, design your own refrigerator with, you know, interchangeable door colors, or, you know, it's kind of different countertop colors or different styles, and that becomes the focus of innovation once the technology becomes kind of standardized.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about some of the effects and impacts of this innovation and this technology too when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Sushi Master, the new book by Nick Sakagami. Sushi Master is an expert guide to sourcing, making, and enjoying sushi at home. As the only person outside of Japan to earn the designation Osakana Meister, Nick Sakagami introduces the fundamentals of sushi, starting with the fish. Photography from Tokyo's Tsukiji Fish Market offers an inside look at where most of our tuna comes from. And a deep dive into the tools, techniques, and etiquette of sushi ensure you'll never look at a California roll the same way again. Sushi Master comes out on June 4th, 2019.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Sarah Archer, and she has a wonderful new book just out called The Mid-Century Kitchen. And I have to admit, the mid-century modern period is probably one of my favorite design periods. It's really terrific.
It's kind of hard to resist.
Yeah, it really is. And we were talking earlier about Khrushchev saying, well, we don't force our women to, you know, stay in the kitchen. They're doing other things too. You know, all of these technological advances, not all of them. I mean, they were wonderful. Let's deny that. But they were supposedly supposed to make things more convenient, and there were other products coming along too, like, you know, mix masters, box mixes, TV dinners, all kinds of things. It was supposed to make life easier for women, but in fact, in a certain way, it kind of tied them even more so to the kitchen.
It is, and what you're identifying is this really interesting confluence of two different impulses that were shaping consumerism and gender politics during the 20th
right.
century. One is that starting in the late 1920s, ad men were keenly aware, especially during the Depression, that durable goods, in a sense, had to be turned into throwaway goods in order to keep the economy humming along. Mm-hmm. So instead of, like, you would maybe buy a new razor every 3 months or 6 months, you know, it's like we have to start training consumers to think of things like stoves or cars as in the context of, like, annual styling. Like, we have to, you know, start getting them to think of them as things that you sort of use up and then find a new one, to train people to be robust consumers so that we can kind of keep all this going. And in the post-war period, when women are decidedly supposed to be in the home, you have, on the one hand, this impulse on the part of corporations saying, this device is going to make your life easier and it's really, really great. But on the other hand, it can't be too good because you need to be devoted to housework, right? So it can't eliminate the work. It just has to make it so that it's kind of like not a big deal and you can, like, wear pearls and then go play tennis and it's not going to take over your life. So it keeps advertisers had to really almost kind of walk a tightrope of making it seem as though all these devices would, you know, kind of implicitly, like, improve your sex life or kind of, you know, make your husband happier because you won't be working so hard, or make your children, you know, smarter and healthier because you have all this extra time to kind of spend with them. But never does it imply that, like, well, all of this is taken care of, so you can, like, go back to grad school and kind of do your own thing.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
That's never the message.
Yeah, if anyone who's read Laura Shapiro's great Something from the Oven knows well, you have a box mix, cake mix, and you have a mix master. So what does that tell us? We should be baking more? I mean, so there we are,
exactly.
You know, tied to the counter. Speaking of box mixes and TV dinners, there were, of course, then there was Pyrex, and you talk a lot about that. And there was something that then maybe attempted to give women a bit of freedom, if you will, or their own pin money, as they called it. And that was Tupperware.
Yeah.
Or just, well, let's talk about, man, I mean, there's plastic in general. I mean, that was a brand new thing, too. But
yes, that was really kind of, yeah, plastic appears in, Tupperware is one of the most visible forms of it, but it was used in, you know, even kind of the rubber that kind of makes the seal of your dishwasher, like all those sort of, or the seal of the refrigerator, all of those were sort of post-World War II innovations in terms of incorporating them into consumer products, which made them more efficient. But there's also that smell, like that plasticky smell that we all are very used to because we live in the 21st century and it's everywhere. But it, you know, that smell when you sort of unfold like a new shower curtain liner, that, you know, which, like, is not great for you to inhale. That was totally alien to people in the 40s and 50s. It was completely new, and it was sort of alarming. And, you know, consumers didn't love Tupperware at first because it was sort of like, oh, what is that? Like, that's kind of, you know, you're not used to that in the kitchen. You're used to, like, glass mixing bowls, right, or ceramics or something inorganic that kind of doesn't, you know, that's not kind of rigid and yet floppy and kind of pink and green and yellow and in these sort of weird colors and has this unusual smell. So one of the reasons that the Tupperware party was introduced was to get women used to sort of seeing and using Tupperware in somebody's house to sort of see how they would use it themselves and get used to it. And it became this kind of social thing. So it was sort of like a little bit like the Avon of that era.
Right.
There were these you know, kind of local saleswomen who would sort of have parties and sell Tupperware, and that was kind of your extra, as you say, pin money. It was sort of, you know, not the kind of money that could support a whole family, but, you know, made it worth your while to kind of incorporate that into your routine.
All right. Well, you mentioned earlier, too, the pearls and heels. I love all those pictures in those old ads for the appliances and all the women doing housework, vacuuming in their high heels, and beautiful shirtwaist dresses in pastel colors match the appliances, right? And their pearls. Like, that's what women wore when they were at home. Yeah. Right. You didn't have to get your hands too dirty. But it also spoke to something else and a carryover from, all these innovative pieces of equipment, these appliances. You were in this modernized kitchen. So that newness lent a bit of sophistication to the room, the kitchen as well. And this sophistication led to an interest in different cuisines.
Definitely. There was absolutely a sense that between recipe books and magazines and kind of post-war interest in different kinds of foods and TV shows like The French Chef with Julia Child, and the kitchen was then suddenly kind of like almost like a command center where you could explore the world without leaving your home. And, you had this kind of the new eat-in kitchen where you could entertain, and it wasn't kind of a dingy workspace, but rather kind of a cool-looking, sort of decorated space where you could invite people over. And these kind of semi-international or domesticated crazes like fondue or hors d'oeuvres that were kind of supposedly based on South Pacific cuisine, which was largely invented but was nevertheless very popular during the tiki craze. All sorts of things like that, and even sort of experimenting with, Asian cooking, and, speaks to kind of a radical shift in how people were shopping, too, because really, this was, I think back to, like, what my mother describes growing up in the 40s and 50s, and that they didn't have black pepper in the house. Like, literally, that was sort of like a spice too far, or it was, sort of like Irish Catholic, like, meat and potatoes, and it was just spices were not part of the routine. And it's things that we think of nowadays. We have, you can Google, how to make your own kimchi, and people are doing all this, kind of really exploring the world culinarily. But it was mediated in a way through magazines and, kind of novelty cookbooks about like food from Hawaii or food from the Orient or what have you. And people were really, really gravitated to that.
Right. And I mean, it really came about, as you said. I mean, the kitchen became a marketable item. I mean, magazines, cookbooks, as you mentioned, all of these things that led people to do a little exploring and experimenting. As long as you're stuck in the kitchen, you might as well make it fun.
Might as well. It's basically like, here you are, and things have become, quote-unquote, easier for you. Mm-hmm. So while you're there, here are all the kind of nifty ways that you can kind of enrich your family's life or entertain in this, kind of exotic way. And I think there was almost a sense that you can kind of, like, here's a new thing that you can serve, and people have never seen this before.
That's right.
Polynesian, some sort of invented Polynesian hors d'oeuvre or what have you. To kind of give people a sense of worldliness and culture. And that's kind of a long-held human need. People were going to World's Fairs 100 years earlier because you could see exotic things and, ceramics and fans and, from across the world. That's always been a human curiosity. So
that's
that's sort of having that enter the kitchen was kind of a logical next step.
Right. And the kitchen became a showpiece in its own right. And as I said at the top of the show, kitchen is where everyone ends up hanging out anyway, whether you have a little kitchen or a big kitchen. But these kitchens were really designed for people to gather. There was often a countertop that one could gather behind while presumably the woman was doing the work on the other side of it, dishing out hors d'oeuvres or something. It was pretty with all the colors. It was a place where you would welcome people and want to show off your new fancy kitchen. And I got to tell you, you take a look at some of these.
Stuff. Yeah.
But didn't mean to interrupt you, but, my thought as I was looking at a lot of the photographs in your book, I'm saying, I would love to have any one of those kitchens.
I know, me too.
They look pretty cool to me. But and that brings me to something that you wrote in the beginning of the book, which I feel is a perfect end, and that is that, except for maybe the microwave, very little has changed.
Yeah, right? That's the really wild thing. It's like if you look at sort of what people actually use, putting aside, you know, we all know somebody who has like one of those seltzer makers or a sous vide or, you know, there's all sorts of different gadgets. Of course, there are microwaves, which didn't become widespread until the 1980s. But apart from that, essentially, like, if you lived long enough to have experienced, you know, coal stoves and no running water and all of that, and then in the post-war era got yourself like a 1950s, you know, kitted out kitchen, that was life-changing. And we haven't really had a change like that since.
No.
You know, in the 70 years since then, it's basically like different colors. Maybe now, like, people are really into soapstone, you know, it, as countertops. But basically, the standard kitchen cabinet and counter heights, the dimensions, the way that we store food, how we cook, the ingredients we stock, what dimensions a refrigerator needs to have and what features it needs to have. You know, there are certainly newfangled things like refrigerator doors that you can see through, you know, certain
smart
things like
refrigerators.
That. But we have not gotten to the point of like the robot maid, right? Like that sort of Jetsons moment where, and it's in a funny way, after all these decades in the middle of the century where there was a real focus on the kitchen of the future, people are also really looking to the past, like looking at, you know, sort of trying to avoid plastic by kind of choosing things like metal or glass, fermenting things on their own, you know, doing all the kind of food prep stuff that our great grandparents did, as though it's like this cool new thing, you know, that they've discovered. But there's this kind of longing to get back to something a little less newfangled.
Yes,
you know, and
I think you're
more
right.
Kind of tried and true. Yeah,
you're right. And then we look to say, well, what? So where are we going next? I think you had mentioned something earlier, and that's it's more about now the innovations we're seeing is how we procure our food, where we get it. I mean, the delivery services. You know, pick up a phone.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Go to your computer and order up. You know, all your goods for the week, and there it is on your doorstep.
Well, and that's kind of the big change. I mean, if things like having running water and having a gas stove were kind of the big sea changes of, let's say, the 20s and 30s, like, for our lifetime, it's really been the digital revolution and the way in which you can get delivered absolutely anything that you need, find any recipe anywhere in the world from your phone. You know, all the things we do in the kitchen are now mediated by having access to the internet, and that is a huge change. And having you know, meal kits mean that you don't have to worry about kind of shopping for the week and having things go bad and wasting food. And like, that's, if it works for you, I think meal kits are a great thing. And also a real awareness and focus on where your food is coming from. So in a sense, it's sort of less about the appliances and more about kind of, you know, oh, should I join a CSA or can I go, you know, where's my nearest green market, or, you know, how do I plan, you know, sort of meal plan for the week so I make sure everything is fresh when I need it and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And those are almost sort of like very old concerns, you know, kind of where your food is coming from and how to keep it. It's just, you know, almost like we've gone back in time 100 years. But
that's,
I think it speaks to a desire for people to eat healthfully and to be mindful of, you know, who's growing it and how it's being grown and where it's coming from.
Excellent. So you can have your newfangled kitchen. And by the way, men know how to use those appliances now, too.
They sure do.
Right. And not that it makes the food any different, but I think certainly our food has gotten a lot better as far as what comes out of the kitchen. Definitely.
I think so, too. Yeah. I absolutely agree.
Well, Sarah, I appreciate your having put this book together because, as I say, it's a wonderful era, design era, and it was such a shift for us here in America, and women in particular. You have to say, yes, we were stuck in the kitchen, but
absolutely.
Hey, at least it made it a little easier, you know? And I think it's a wonderful book, and it's called, again, The Mid-Century Kitchen by Sarah Archer. Thanks for joining me, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
And thank you for listening. This has been another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.